It's fun to be inquisitive. Be nosy. Stick to your passion. Find out more for yourself. Quest is fun. Join me, Tristan Pang, on a journey of inspiration. Welcome to Youth Voices.
Hello everyone, welcome to my show. This is your host Tristan Pang on Planet FM 104.6. Youth Voices, great to have your company here today. I'm settling into Oxford very well now. My graduate program is very intense and I'm basically working non-stop on my assignments. So I rarely have time to go outside because of my heavy workload as well as the spiking COVID cases here in Oxford. But luckily I could stroll around before my term started. Something very interesting is that a day before Sir Roger Penrose's Nobel Prize announcement, I took a lot of pictures outside my maths department where the floor was laid with Penrose tilings. Then, the day later, I heard about Sir Roger's great achievement. If you had the chance to watch my TED Talk, which I delivered when I was 11, I talked about Roger Penrose as one of my role models. I was introduced to him by my uncle who sent me one of his books, The Road to Reality. Roger Penrose is indeed a very inspiring person. He is an English mathematical physicist, and he is one of the professors at the University of Oxford, receiving one half of the 2020 Nobel Prize in Physics, with Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez, who shared the remaining half for the discovery that black hole formation is a robust prediction of the general theory of relativity. So what are black holes? Well, there's a really good article on plus.mass.org which says that black holes are a result of gravitation, one of the fundamental forces of nature which dictates what happens in our universe at large scales. Our best theory of gravity was developed by Albert Einstein and published in 1915. It's called the general theory of relativity. General relativity is extremely successful, but it's far from easy to work with. You need some very serious math. What it tells us about the gravitational pull of a single object, though, is easy to understand. The smaller and more massive the object is, the stronger the gravitational pull will be. Thus, if you could crush a celestial body, such as our sun, down to a smaller size while keeping the same mass, you'd increase its gravitational pull. Plus mass then goes on to say that this raises an intriguing possibility. If an object is small and massive enough, could its gravitational pull be so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape its vicinity? Shortly after Einstein published his general relativity theory, the physicist Karl Schwarzschild was able to solve its very tricky equations to describe what we would now recognize as a black hole, albeit a very simple one, perfectly round and non-rotating. It took a while, however, until people realized what Schwarzschild's solution actually meant and came up with the idea that a black hole would be surrounded by an event horizon. That's an invisible barrier of no return. If you cross the event horizon, you never get out again. But only because black holes can exist in theory doesn't mean that they actually exist for real, which is why some theorists ask themselves how a black hole might form out there in nature from objects we do not know exist. Theorists suggested that gravitational collapse might be the culprit. The idea was that huge stars can run out of fuel, causing them to first explode in a huge supernova and then collapsing in on themselves. The result would be a lot of mass packed into a small space that the black hole results. Not everyone was convinced. The idea of black holes didn't sit comfortably with many physicists, not so because it's scary, but because theoretical descriptions of black holes involve singularities, points at which certain quantities, for example density or the curvature of space-time, become infinite. Since we never see any infinities in real life, physicists are cautious of singularities. When one comes up in theory, it's often a sign that something is wrong. Although the work of Oppenheimer and others were mathematically sound, it did rest on a number of assumptions. For example, that all stars and black holes would be perfectly round and symmetrical. This, as skeptics pointed out, was unrealistic. And they concluded that something about the wonkiness of real celestial objects would probably prevent the gravitational collapse of massive stars into black holes. It was then Roger Penrose who proved them wrong, showing that a lack of symmetry won't stop the formation of a black hole. Using revolutionary mathematical tools, he had developed to deal with the ferocious mass of general relativity. Penrose proved his famous singularity theorem in 65. It showed that singularities are generic phenomena in general relativity, which occur in gravitational collapse, no matter if there's symmetry or not. Penrose's work not only legitimized black holes, it was also a starting point for future work. Inspired by Penrose, Stephen Hawking began to wonder whether there could be a singularity at the very beginning of our universe. Hawking eventually showed that, according to general relativity, such a singularity was not only possible, it was inevitable. The singularity is now what we know as the Big Bang. The fact that it really did happen around 13.8 billion years ago is now beyond scientific doubt. Penrose's theoretical methods remain essential tools for physicists trying to understand the nature of our universe. Penrose's work was entirely theoretical, focusing on what can and cannot happen within the framework of general relativity. It's Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Kies we have to thank for the conclusive proof that the existence of black holes, not just anywhere, but at the center of our very own Milky Way galaxy. Since black holes don't emit any light, you can't see them. So Genzel and Kies reached for another method to prove that there's one in the Milky Way. They looked at how a huge gravitational pull of a hypothetical black hole would influence the motion of surrounding stars. In separate research efforts lasting for over 30 years, they trained increasingly sophisticated telescopes at the center of the Milky Way. Their measurements, which agreed admirably, provided convincing evidence that a black hole did indeed lurk there. It's around 4 million times as massive than our Sun and fits into a region the size of our solar system. But what really happens at the center of any black hole remains a mystery. The singularities of general relativity are in fact regions of space-time in which all known laws of physics break down. But physicists around the world are working hard on this problem. And those who finally solve it certainly look forward to a Nobel Prize of their own. And that was the article by plusmass.org. Now we continue our chat with my mentor, Andrew Batson. I started this part of the interview by asking about how we can help the two ends of the educational spectrum.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting situation, isn't it? You know, I've obviously, from my time working in gifted education with, as you know, president of the New Zealand Association for Gifted Children for a couple of years, I mean, that taught me a lot about that area as well and the challenges that go with it. I think what's exciting for gifted students, particularly, you know, like yourself, there's this ability to just sort of dive in now and not have any constraints around where they can go in the future. And I thought that came through really well in that Brain Boxes series that you took part in last year on TVNZ. If you look at each of those students, how engaged they were in their learning in lots of different areas, and that, you know, that's really exciting. I think for, you know, students at the other end of the spectrum, perhaps some of those that are challenged by traditional learning environments, I think, you know, again, the ability to make learning interesting and engaging and relevant to their interests is just going to get more and more exciting in the future as we, and then that's where I think, again, as we were saying before, the idea of these kind of copycat versions of Khan Academy. I mean, imagine a Khan Academy site that's really interested for kids who are interested into motor mechanics, for instance, and all it did was feature about how to take a car apart and how all the different aspects of a car work. You know, for a kid that's really into something like that, that'd be like gold. It'd be a bit like you sort of with a math site, you know.
Yeah, so
tailoring the learning to interests could be fascinating. Or kids that are really interested in animals and veterinary science and everything. I mean, it's just an unlimited series of possibilities out there.
I guess it's just the flexibility and how there's no limit on the distance.
No.
You can be anywhere in the world and learn anything you want. And I think the world's going in the right direction at the moment to kind of step towards this ideal education environment.
Yeah, and also the fact that your education, the way that you tackle your education, it doesn't have to be constrained by a particular way of doing it. I mean, the other part that I guess, you know, we've known for a long time, but COVID has reinforced is homeschooling, because that's exactly. I mean, effectively everybody's been homeschooled for the last 4 months, and there must be a lot of there'd be a lot of parents who, you know, will be quite happy to see their kids back to school. But equally, I would say that, you know, there'll be parents who said, you know, I actually really enjoyed you know, being more involved in my child's education, and I want to do that. So maybe again these kind of hybrid models. I've read of, you know, businesses where they're going to work from home, say 2 days a week, and they go into the office, say 3 days a week. Well, you could do the same thing in a schooling environment, couldn't you? Maybe you go to school 3 days a week, and you have 2 days at home where you're homeschooled. I mean, that opens up a whole you know, range of possibilities, and you know, you, again, the opportunity for kids to kind of jump into areas that really interest them in those 2 days. I know, you know, the gifted students will be very familiar with the one-day school concept, which has been very popular with you know, with gifted students. Well, imagine if you made that possibility open to every kid. I think that's quite exciting.
Exactly, yeah, and I mean, that's kind of where we're heading in the next couple of years, but how about in 10, 20 years, where do you see the classroom education?
I think that's difficult to forecast. I mean, in the end, it comes down to the willingness of governments and bureaucrats to change.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, with all due respect to the Ministry of Education, they are trying to run a system which is based on kind of a McDonald's-style model, you know, that, you know, every school is basically the same and every school kind of teaches the same and everybody follows the same curriculum and all those sort of things. I wonder, in a world that's, you know, very focused around kind of agile and disruption, if that kind of model is going to work. So it's really the willingness, I think, of ministry, government ministries to be willing to think about different ideas and embrace those opportunities in the future. That will be like the speed limiter as to how quickly we begin to change.
Yeah, and hopefully that does happen, and maybe a couple of years later we'll look back and realize how far we've come.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting when we think back to, you know, schooling today really doesn't differ that much from schooling 50 years ago. And this has always been Sal Khan's hobby horse, that effectively, you know, we've just kind of tweaked around the edges. But imagine if we, you know, we made those fundamental reforms and we, you know, we built, you know, more online learning platforms, and we allowed students flexibility to be at home some days. Now, obviously for some students where they've got parents working, that's not going to work. But maybe you might have a parent who decides to put a small little group of students together with a common interest. All of those sorts of... I've always been interested in that, you know, that great African proverb, you know, it takes a village to raise a child.
Exactly.
I always argue the problem is we don't use the village.
yeah.
You know, we tend to still see kind of schools as the domain in which this is actually conducted, and others don't really get involved that much.
But the village now is the whole world.
The village now is the whole world. That's exactly right. And it's this idea of thinking about the way everybody can make a contribution to that. I'm amazed. I visited East Timor, a little country that I've been always very interested in. It's a very poor little country. It's about an hour's flying north of Darwin, at the top of Australia, and it's got a population of about 1 million people. It's rated by the UN as, you know, in the 20 poorest countries. But I was very interested when I first went to East Timor in 2005. You know, they had virtually no mobile phone coverage, and I went back in January this year to a little village that I visited first in 2005. And when I went back, Tristan, they have not one, not two, but 3 mobile phone towers now, right wow. in the middle of this little village in a very remote area. So they've got, you know, really good 3G connectivity. So I can now run a little, every couple of weeks, I run a little English language program for the kids at the local school there. Mm. And there's about 5 students that I teach, and I just do it all via Zoom or Skype. And we just, you know, I can teach them from my house. It's all of those sort of things are possible now. And you can see the difference that kind of makes, the way that, you know, they get engaged with somebody from another country, and they learn from that experience, and you can help them, and all that's possible as a result of, you know, these advances that are now going on.
Yeah, and I guess that's really helping the whole world.
We continue with the last part of the interview with Andrew next month on the last show of the year. So that's all for today. I welcome your feedback and the support of the program, so please email me at youthvoicesnz@gmail.com or visit my website www.questisfun.org.nz/youthvoices. So see you next month. Bye.
Join me again for another exciting program next month on the first Wednesday at 2:10 p.m. or listen anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/youthvoices or listen to the archive on my website www.questisfun.org.nz/youthvoices. Youth Voices.